I'm David Lazarus, and this is the Marketplace Weekend Podcast for the weekend of March 27th, 2015. We're talking about waiting this week, and if you don't mind waiting, I just got to put in a quick call to the cable company.
This call may be monitored or recorded. You may have to be transferred more than once. I'll connect you with the next available customer service representative.
All right. While I'm waiting, let's move ahead with the show. This is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy meets real life. That can occasionally mean cooling your heels, economically speaking. It's for your wallet, for entire countries, even for a living. What do you wait for when it comes to your personal economy? Let us know by visiting MarketplaceWeekend.org and clicking on Go, or you can tweet us. We're at MarketplaceWKND. Let's look at something that has many of us waiting every day, parking. If you're a city dweller, parking can be a make-or-break proposition for how your day is going to go. It's all about supply and demand. You demand a spot to stash your car, and there just isn't enough supply to go around. And so it begins. The circling the neighborhood, the crossing of the fingers, the silent prayers that someone is about to pull out from the most primo space imaginable. But it's not just about divine intervention. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson looked at another, more down-to-earth aspect of parking, how it's priced. And she's here to tell us about it now. Hiya, Tracy.
Hey, David.
All right, so when we're talking about parking here, it's not just about waiting for serendipity to strike. There's actually the question of cost.
Right. Price has a lot to do with it. And I started thinking about this recently when I put $3.50 in the meter, went and had coffee with a friend and came back out to find that terrible orange slip of paper on my dashboard. And, you know, $65 later, that coffee became a lot more expensive. So it started me thinking about that $3.50 meter, the price of the parking ticket. And I called up some smart folks and asked them about it. And I started to get a bunch of answers like this.
I don't know, you know, whether it should be $1 or $2. Why those are the right number for parking? I'm not sure. As a parking expert, I don't know where those numbers, you know, come from.
That's John Guo, urban planner at NYU, and he's been studying parking for a couple of years. It's not that he just doesn't know, but trying to come up with the right price for parking is shockingly hard for researchers and for cities. It's this kind of Goldilocks issue that affects local shops and businesses just as much as it affects us, the residents who are circling for a spot.
Wait a minute, Goldilocks, like my porridge isn't hot enough?
Exactly. Like the price is too high or the price is too low. Both of those would be problems that affect the turnover of spots, which affects the businesses around them.
If the rate is too high, you will, you know, hurt the local business. People will not come over to make a stop, right? And if the rate is too low, and people will occupy the same area, maybe too much.
So, for example, in parts of New York City, many areas are free. You don't even have to have a resident permit parking sticker like you do in some other cities. And that means there are people like me, I actually do this, who don't need their car for commuting and will just leave our car in the same spot and then only move it once or twice a week for street cleaning. Meters, like we mentioned, are $3.50, and either free or $3.50, Guo says both are way too low.
But too low? I mean, that's, we're talking about 14 quarters here. How can it be too low?
Well, yeah, I mean, we're pretty accustomed to cheap meters. We take it very personally when our city officials try and raise the rates. It becomes a political process very fast. But the low rates mean that people would rather circle around for that spot instead of, you know, say, coughing up the money for a private garage. Joel says actually at any given time, a third of drivers on the road in a downtown area are circling looking for a spot. A third.
Well, what's the answer to that? That we all just stay home instead of going out driving?
Maybe, kind of, sort of. It's a supply and demand problem. The demand in certain areas is often way higher than the supply, and yet prices don't reflect that. Except in some cities, for example, San Francisco just finished a pilot program where over the course of a couple of years, they played with the price of parking in certain neighborhoods. Now, it wasn't just an across-the-board increase to try and get people to stay home. They increased and decreased simultaneously. So the idea is in one neighborhood, say the Marina, they would raise rates on a really busy street, but then drop them on a quieter street nearby. And the idea is you draw more price-sensitive people away from the busy areas, and then you distribute the parking more evenly. So they would tweak the prices by maybe a quarter, maybe 50 cents every few months, raising them up or down, until they reached their goal, which was having one empty spot about per block at any given time. No more circling.
You're describing this market-efficient supply-and-demand kind of scenario, and then let's go back to that parking ticket you just got. Where does that fit into the equation?
Yeah, there's no universal right answer there. It ranges, you'll see, across different cities what different violations are charged. Rachel Weinberger with the Nelson Nagard Consulting Associates says often the point of parking tickets, in addition to, of course, you know, bringing in some revenue for cities, is to discourage certain behaviors, to slap us on the wrist when we're doing something wrong.
But generally, cities try to figure out a system where they're trying to encourage the right behavior. So it's more expensive to park in a handicap-designated zone illegally than it is to overstay your meter.
So overstaying your meter, like I said, was about $65 for me the other week. Not moving for street cleaning, that was something like $40. I actually got one of those recently too. Not because I spaced with the meter. That time I was traveling and I actually calculated that ticket, that $40 about, was cheaper than putting the car in a private garage while I was going away. So yeah, so there's a Goldilocks element here too. Too low, people like me don't really care about the violation. Too high, the punishment won't fit the crime and people will be upset.
I hope you fed the meter before this interview.
I took the subway here today.
Smart. You see, there's the market in action, teaching people lessons right there. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson bringing us the surprisingly tricky business of pricing parking. Thanks, Tracy.
Thank you.
You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. We're talking about the economic aspects of waiting this week. And that got us thinking about all sorts of jobs that involve waiting. You know, like maybe pharmacy reps who are waiting for doctors, or first responders who are waiting for something to respond to, or process servers like George Gokjin. He owns AMPM Process Servers in Los Angeles. For the last 14 years, he's been delivering or serving legal documents for clients all over Southern California. And needless to say, not all the people he's serving want to be served, because we're talking about here restraining orders, court orders, small claims, wage garnishment, civil lawsuits. Things can go smoothly, but sometimes it involves a lot of waiting. And George doesn't just wait around for free. He averages around $75 an hour. That's serving or waiting. We caught up with him in his car on the way to serve that most common of legal documents, divorce papers. Here's George.
We're in downtown Los Angeles, and we're headed to East LA to serve some divorce documents. We have the documents hidden so we can surprise them once we get there. We're going to go to the location, right? All right. You'll see the whole thing. Facebook, social media, Twitter, these are just fantastic for process servers. We love it, you know. It works miracles. Because we can see how they look. Sometimes they tell us exactly where they are. So we're coming close to this location here. 742, let's see here. I'm going to go inside the house, well, in front of the door, to see if I can serve these legal documents on James, Mr. James here. The most important thing is, you know, to be patient. Patience is the key in this field, and not to get mad. You know, you have to always be calm. Some people go through it once in their life. You know, getting served, it might be dramatic for them. So you have to take that into consideration. It's like, you know, don't shoot the messenger. I'm just the messenger. You know.
All right, let's pause for a sec. The paperwork is changing hands at this point, but for privacy reasons, we're going to go ahead to right afterward.
We served the documents. Who's cool about it? You hear people's problems and you listen to them and then, you know, you try to be positive and tell them everything's going to be okay. You know, things happen for a reason. You can tell a stranger things you wouldn't tell somebody you know. I'm probably not going to get married because of all these divorce documents that I serve. It's pretty crazy. I've served people that have been married 6 months, 8 months, 1 year, 2 years. A lot of those servings, you know. Sometimes they tell you everything.
And we're happy to serve you, not with court papers, but with the good stuff. Find us online at marketplaceweekend.org, or you can chase us down on Twitter, MarketplaceWKND. Okay, at least I'm not the only guy waiting in line. Coming up, we'll hear from a few other people cooling their heels.
We have waited 2 hours before.
For the right thing, I would do too.
Please continue to hold. There's more Marketplace Weekend just ahead.
We're talking about the economic aspects of waiting this week. Before we get to that, though, we here at Marketplace, as you know, are all about the numbers. And every day in our By the Numbers blog on Marketplace.org, we give you the numbers worth watching. Here's digital producer Tobin Lowe to catch you up on the week's biggest economic news, By the Numbers. Hiya, Tobin.
Hey, David. So, our first number.
$5 billion.
Is roughly how much the U.S. spice and seasoning industry is worth. And as Americans have become increasingly health conscious, they've started cooking more at home, which also means they're reaching for their spice rack more than ever. The spice industry has seen a boost in sales lately, and McCormick & Company is hoping to cash out on that trend. But niche brands are also starting to crowd the market, which means the competition is getting spicy. Sorry.
$28 billion.
That's the estimated revenue for Kraft Heinz Co., the company that will form as a result of the merger between Kraft Foods and the H.J. Heinz Company. Once the two have come together, the newly formed juggernaut will be the fifth largest food and beverage company. That's a whole lot of ketchup on a whole lot of macaroni. And may I say, ew.
$6.
Is how much a one-way bus ride will cost you in San Francisco. That is, if you like your commute with reclaimed wood, Wi-Fi, and fancy juice. Transportation startup Leap recently launched 5 buses into rotation, all outfitted with the creature comforts of a designer coffee shop. As The Verge reports, some people in the tech industry think privately owned companies like Leap are the key to fixing public transit.
1.2 billion euros.
Another tough break for Greece this week as it attempts to fight off bankruptcy. A 1.2 billion euro payment request was denied by the Eurozone Rescue Fund. Greece had asked for the money to prevent bankruptcy, which could happen as soon as next month. As Reuters reports, some are saying Athens will run out of money on April 20th without some kind of aid.
Visit By the Numbers blog at marketplace.org for your fix of each day's most important figures. And that last number, the one about Greece, that's the really important one, because our theme this week is waiting, and Greece is waiting for its bank accounts to run dry. Beginning this week, the country's financial officials have said they think that's maybe going to happen in about 2 weeks. 2 weeks? Seriously? All right, Marketplace's Wizard of Whiteboard, Patty Hirsch, joins me now to talk about Europe's waiting game with Greece and what might happen when it ends. Hiya, Patty.
Hi, David.
So let's talk about Greece. What is going to happen when these guys run out of money?
Let's be absolutely accurate here. It's not like they're going to run out of cash altogether in 2 weeks. What they're talking about is they're saying that they're not going to be able to make payments on their loans, mainly to the IMF, and also make payments for pensions and government salaries. It's kind of like a homeowner who has taken a pay cut so deep that she can't pay both the mortgage and feed her family. She's going to have to make a choice.
That affects Greece directly, clearly. I'm not clear on how that affects me on the other side of the Atlantic, first of all. And when that moment comes, what are they going to do to deal with it?
The short answer is, you on the other side of the Atlantic doesn't really affect us at all. In fact, you could say that the whole Greece debacle has been totally priced in, as they say, on Wall Street, into everyone's calculations. This is like a really slow motion train wreck. Everybody knows what's happening, why it's happening, how it's happening, and now they pretty much know when it's going to happen. It's not going to make a blind bit of difference to your stock portfolio, so do not panic.
So what's the Greek government doing now to deal with this?
Well, it's negotiating frantically, right, which is what we're seeing in all of these news reports. But that said, whilst we're waiting around to see what happens in Greece, the Greeks themselves are not waiting around. Many of them are going down to the bank, running down to the bank and pulling as much of their money out as they can. You know, they withdrew 1.5 billion euros from Greek banks just last week. So the banking system, right, is like this guy who's got a gunshot wound and he's losing blood because the doctors just can't plug it properly. It's just, you know, hemorrhaging out of him. So they're trying to pump blood into him or infusing blood or money in the form of these emergency liquidity assistance programs, so-called. But unfortunately, people are taking cash out of the bank quicker than the central bank can pump it in.
Now, at what point do the Germans and the other Europeans lose patience with all of this and say, you know, it's been fun having you in the Euro Club, but enough's enough?
Well, I think the Germans lost patience a while ago. And in fact, Germans were polled last week to see how they felt about Greeks leaving the euro. Most of them said, you know, we don't care. If they leave the euro, that's fine. Most analysts are saying, you know, if Greece had to go, it actually wouldn't be such a bad thing. You know, it's not like the whole system would collapse. People are ready for it. People are factoring it in. People are now, I think, beginning to expect it.
But does that mean that people start then looking askance at Spain and Portugal and Ireland and thinking, all right, well, if Greece is out of the club, these other guys...
Yeah, that's the concern. Is the concern there's a domino effect here. They called them the pigs, right? Remember Portugal, Italy, Ireland, Greece and Spain? These were the troubled economies. And the concern is that if a small economy like Greece departs, that maybe the malaise translates to a larger economy, a seriously large economy like Spain. And if Spain goes, then, you know, the whole house of cards comes down.
So what's the end game here?
Well, the end game is that the Greeks are still going to negotiate, and you may find that they've managed to strike a deal that the Germans will approve of and they'll be able to hold on. But, you know, the real issue is that Greece has got a decision to make. Either it pays its loans or it doesn't. It's not going to not pay its loans to the IMF. That's an absolute mandate. I mean, it has to do that. So now it has to decide whether or not it's going to pay its workers. And the only way it can do that is either by shrinking that workforce so that it's actually a manageable size that it can actually pay, or it decides to just renege on all of its loans, step out of the eurozone, and let the chips fall.
As usual, words of wisdom from Patty Hirsch. Thank you, Patty.
It's my pleasure, David.
This week, Marketplace teams up with the New York Times to bring you stories of big financial lessons learned. Here's one of them. Writer Anne Carnes talks expensive dolls, growing up, and waiting. Yeah, there's that word again, for something you want.
After I spent a weekend packing away toys that my children had outgrown, Elizabeth, Felicity, Julie, Kaya, Kristen, and Kit were nestled safely in plastic bins. If you don't recognize those names, you probably don't have a young daughter or granddaughter, or at least not one who plays with dolls. They are all American Girl puppets, and the six of them, plus others like the Biddy Twins, the brand's dolls for younger girls, consumed an inordinate amount of my family's toy budget over the last decade. Actually, budget is a bit of a fib. implying that there was some sort of rational limit to what I'd spend on American Girl items. I'd conservatively estimate that the dolls in those containers, in their outfits, furniture, pets, hairbrushes, books, and accessories, are worth about $2,500. That's a sum larger than our monthly mortgage payment. It's more than a year of tuition at some community colleges. And that doesn't include related spending, like hairstyling visits to the doll salon at the American Girl store. In my defense, the money wasn't spent in a lump sum on one child, but on two girls over 7 years or so. Santa might bring a doll for Christmas, then Mommy and Daddy would follow up with a gift of clothing or a related item on the next birthday. Still, $2,500 is a lot of money. How did that happen? I wanted to delight my girls, yes. I had them relatively late in life, and my parents died before they could do much fussing over their granddaughters. But, as my perceptive husband noted, the dolls were as much about me and my own childhood experience. "You're the one who wants this stuff," he observed. Indeed, I did. When I was a little girl in the 1960s, I would await, with exquisite anticipation, the arrival of the holiday catalog from FAO Schwartz.
To hear the rest of Anne's piece, visit marketplaceweekend.org and check out her story in the New York Times. You're listening to Marketplace Weekend, and since it's the weekend, many of you might be planning on waiting in line for brunch. I know I am. Is this you?
Waiting in line for brunch.
We're waiting in line for brunch.
Standing in line.
Probably 15 minutes.
30 minutes is fast.
Well, it's moving, so maybe 45 minutes.
Possibly this line will never move. But
I'm really hungry.
We already thought about leaving right when we saw the line.
Waiting a little bit is, I think, actually good practice, too, in patience. So
I'm, like, zoning out. I'm hungover. I'm just dealing with that. I'm not thinking about time. Yeah.
We are having a really good time talking to each other right here.
Talk.
Yeah, we talk.
Yeah, the girl in front of us was reading a book.
That was a good one. That's better than staring at Instagram.
We check Instagram obsessively.
No, but I've been eyeing the food as I stand here.
Just like wondering if it's actually going to move as fast as I anticipate that it will.
It's an investment being in the line.
35 minutes just to order.
Doesn't feel like we've been in line that long.
Yeah, when you're hungry, it's a pain. I'm nervous about what I'm going to order. I don't know what I'm going to order.
Trying to judge, like, oh, I've been standing a little bit longer than I thought.
Then we yelped places around here when we saw the line was really long. And by the time we were kind of done with the search, we were still in line and we just decided to stay.
Thanks to everyone who talked to us while waiting to eat in the totally hip Silver Lake neighborhood of Los Angeles. As we just heard, waiting in line can be frustrating, yet we all do it. We line up at the DMV, we line up for movie tickets, we line up for the latest tech. Some lines are grueling and painful. Try crawling along LA's roads with me sometime. Others, like the ones at theme parks, might be more immersive and even, dare I say, fun. A fun line, you say? How's that even possible? Dick Larson, an engineering professor at MIT and, yes, an expert on lines known as Dr. Q, which is Q European style, not so much 007, he joins us now to talk about how to structure a good line. And he says there's one company that does it better than most.
The Disney people, I think I would write as A double plus, the best scientists and engineers of line management in the world. They have about 20 Imagineers. They call them Imagineers. They're really scientists and engineers. They're industrial engineers, operations researchers. Every amusement at any Disney property has been architected by them. They create the ride, the amusement, on a computer animation. They simulate it. They optimize the size, so they have a trade-off about capital investment versus the line weight. And then when they do design the line, they design all kinds of distractions within the lines, particularly to amuse the age category, particularly of, let's say, the children who might be in line with parents, so that you feel like the amusement has actually started before you get on your 2-minute ride up Space Mountain or something like this.
All right, so let's talk about what Disney can offer perhaps to others, maybe those in the retail sector or the public sector, who don't seem to be as adept at managing lines.
Well, the key thing with the psychology of lines or the psychology of queuing, basically what you've got to look at is take the person's mind off of looking at his or her wristwatch or the time on their cell phone and distract them, entertain them, educate them, do things so that they're not concerned with the passing of each second, the passing of each minute. And this goes back actually to the 1950s in New York City, where there's this famous experiment, people who were complaining about delays for elevators. And a fellow from University of Pennsylvania, the Wharton School, figured out, maybe the issue isn't the delays for the elevators. The issue really is the complaints about the delays for the elevators. So if we can reduce the complaints for the delays for the elevators, we have solved the problem. And so with a spirit of great creativity, he said, let's put mirrors, floor-to-ceiling mirrors, next to each of the elevators and see what happens. Guess what? The complaints for the delays dropped to near zero. The statistics of the delays were unchanged. And to me, this is the birth of the psychology of queuing. Interestingly, Anaheim's Disneyland opened in the same year, and then they became the experts in generalizing this to all kinds of lines.
And it seems like technology is changing the game as well. I mean, in the theme park world, we've been seeing magic bands. We've been seeing fast passes. It seems to be an acknowledgement that, yeah, we know lines are no fun, and here's a way we can manage that.
A lot of service providers are trying to get extra revenue by giving expedited service to folks. You see this in theme parks. You see this with loyalty agreements, frequent flyer programs, that if you stay with a particular airline, you get boarded first, you get upgraded to first class or business class or whatever it is. But, you know, this goes against the idea of fairness, of first come, first serve. So I'm a little bit ambivalent about whether I really support some of these expedited things that you pay more for to jump ahead of me in line if I haven't done that. So it's a complicated trade-off with regard to social fairness and people with money getting there faster.
Waiting is a fact of life. I mean, certainly here in Southern California, people line up for everything from movies to food trucks. Is it a situation that is going to remain as such? Is it going to get worse? Is it going to get better? What's the current thinking from Dr. Q?
I think the line situation today is actually better than it was 50 years ago, but we're more attuned to it, so we get more aggravated with even lesser lines.
Does that mean that even a lesser line will make our kettle boil, or that we're just simply inured to the idea that anything that I want is going to come with some sort of wait time?
Well, you know, it's all a matter of expectation. Research has shown that one's willingness to stand in line, the amount of time, is proportional to the value of service you expect. So if somebody's shopping for the family for a week and you have $200 worth of groceries, you expect to wait in that line for a while because there might be another one or two carts ahead of you like that. But if you go back the next day because you forgot a half a dozen eggs and a quart of milk, you expect to go in and out fast and the express checkout lane. So it's all a matter of expectations. People who go to a big box store with very low prices don't mind waiting because they're happy with the discounts they got. But if you go to an expensive jewelry store, a very expensive upscale jewelry store, you expect a meter greeter at the doorway for you to take you around and service your needs at that store. And so therefore, you expect no waiting. So a lot of this is expectations, and the retailers and the people who provide service need to understand they have to manage the customer's expectations.
What is the one thing you will not stand in line for?
Well, you know, I love lines and I hate them. And I myself, the way I got involved with the psychology of queuing, I had such a bad line experience in a box store once that I made a lifetime pledge never, ever, ever to go back there again. So I asked my students, I said, how many of you have ever had such a bad service experience that you made your lifetime pledge never, ever to go back there again? More than half the students raised their hands. And I think this is something that retailers and service providers don't understand, that if they don't pay a lot of attention to their customers' line experiences, they may lose a customer for life.
Dick Larson is an engineering professor at MIT and is an expert on lines. Dick, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We're talking about waiting and the economy this week, and there is plenty of that in the world of tech.
Today, we're going to be showing our friends the basics of technology. This is Tech in Real Life.
Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to tech in real life. Hiya, Ben.
Hey, David.
All right, so we're talking about waiting this week, and when it comes to waiting, I guess one of the most high-profile pieces of hardware out there is the Apple Watch, which is coming, and I guess a lot of people, like me, are wondering, should I wait, or should I get it as soon as it's available? Ben Johnson, what's the call on that?
Well, it sort of depends on how much of an Apple fanboy you are, David, but it can be really fun to be an early adopter. But if you buy new hardware right when it comes out, you will almost always pay top dollar. I mean, you have to decide whether being first is actually worth, in some cases, a couple hundred extra dollars if you're buying a television or a laptop or even an iPhone. Also, the possibility that hardware could have a defect is something you want to think about. You remember iPhone 4s had this kind of antenna issue in them that ended up being called the antenna gate.
Oh, you people had to put the bumper around it, right?
Yeah, people were getting dropped calls. It was a huge problem. And so, you know, there are more recent examples of that as well. Battery life in some Android smartwatches have been, like, really bad. And people obviously don't want that, but have bought this brand new watch and this brand new hardware experiment. So it's a dicey proposition, or it can be. This might be part of the reason that Apple is actually being very careful with how it releases the Apple Watch. You probably know that the first day that people can actually go into the store and play with the Apple Watch, they don't even get to walk out of the store with it. It's for pre-order only. The watch was announced last fall, but it's taken this long for Apple to actually start to roll it out. And I think part of that is that they want to get people comfortable with the product so that they will actually buy the product. So it'll be interesting to see how that all plays out and if people like you, David, actually buy them and how they do.
Well, I'll be expensing, of course, the one with the gold and the diamonds because that's the way marketplace rolls. And when it comes to new tech like the Apple Watch, I'm always happy to let some other guy be the guinea pig. The thing that, when it comes to hardware at least, that's frustrating for me is when you step into the cycle. For example, the iPhone 5 comes out. Do I get that or do I wait 2 weeks for the iPhone 6? I mean, when do you know when it's time to take the plunge?
One thing that you should watch out for is it is true that, for instance, the new operating system that Apple might push, the new software that Apple might push to its users, might be more designed for the 6 than it is for the 5. And if you're thinking about buying a 5 2 weeks before the 6 comes out, yeah, it might be cheaper, but it also may not have the best functionality when it comes to the operating system or the software.
And that brings up the whole question of software in general. For example, later this year, Microsoft is expected to release Windows 10. It'll be free, amazingly, to people who have Windows 8 and even Windows 7, I think. The question then becomes, do you upgrade right away or do you wait for the Ben Johnsons of this world to step on all the minefields for you and then upgrade a few months later?
So this is my rule of thumb, David. A couple of weeks. Wait a couple of weeks. I waited a couple of weeks. I'm an Android. And I waited a couple of weeks for the new Android operating system. And I'm going to tell you, David, right now, I've been waiting to download the new OS update to Android 5.1. And I'm going to hit the button right now, David. And I waited a little while to do that. I mean, you know, admittedly, I waited to do it with you a little bit. But I think generally speaking,
you want to wait a couple of weeks when a new operating system comes out, because at least you'll know if there's a major software problem or a security hole created by the software update, or the company will actually issue a fix and you can just wait for the fix to come out and then update.
Ben Johnson knows heck a tech, and he joins us every week to talk about it. Ben, thank you so much as usual.
Thank you, David.
I may be cool waiting when it comes to new tech, but in my day-to-day life, I'm not much of a procrastinator. I tell my son not to put off until tomorrow what can be done today, and I pretty much try to do the same myself. But it turns out I could be all wrong. At least Rory Vaden might say so. He's the author of Procrastinate on Purpose, and he joins us now to talk about good procrastination versus bad procrastination. So what's the difference?
So there is a big difference between waiting to do something that you know you should be doing, but you don't feel like doing it, versus waiting because you're deciding that now is not the right time. So waiting to do something that you know you should do, but you don't feel like doing it. That's going to the gym when I don't feel like doing it, or making that sales call, but I have call reluctance, or starting on my taxes. Those are things I know I should be doing, but I don't feel like doing it. That's procrastination. However, waiting to do something because we're deciding intentionally that now is not the right time, that is not a killer of all success. That is a lost art. In fact, it's a virtue. And in one word, it's patience, giving myself permission of the incomplete so that I can temporarily ignore the small things, meanwhile giving myself permission to protect my focus and work on the big things.
First of all, I'm feeling really guilty now about not going to the gym yesterday. Second of all, how do I recognize the thing that I can put off in a positive way versus the thing that I should not put off under any circumstances whatsoever?
It's really about multiplying time. And so the ultimate litmus test for us is that you multiply time by spending time on things today that give you more time tomorrow. We created something called the focus funnel. And if you think of a funnel, at the top, during the wide part of the funnel, is eliminate. And that's the first question. We say, is this even worth doing? If you can't eliminate a task, then it drops down to the middle of the funnel and you say, can I automate this? You know, can I create a process for it today that will save me time tomorrow? If you can't eliminate it or automate it, then the next question is, can I delegate it? Well, if you can't eliminate, automate, or delegate a task, then it drops out the bottom of the funnel and you know it must be done and it must be done by you. And most of us just dive into doing it because we derive our sense of worth from the volume of tasks that we complete, and we kind of have become addicted to just checking off our to-do list or mindlessly just doing whatever is on our calendar. But multipliers ask one remaining question, and that question is, must this task be done now or can it wait until later? And if it must be done now, then that's where we concentrate. But if it is not an activity that multiplies our time, in other words, it doesn't give us more time tomorrow, or it's not an activity that must be done right this second, then that is when we are inviting you to not eliminate, automate, or delegate, but to procrastinate on purpose.
You know, this makes me think of Wimpy from Popeye.
I'll have a hamburger, for which I will gladly pay you Tuesday.
So is this guy procrastinating in a good way or a bad way there?
Well, I would say when it comes to money, waiting is typically a good idea. In fact, one of the things that wealthy people do, which was something that growing up poor I never understood, is that wealthy people never pay their taxes early. Doing something early is an underutilization of our greatest asset, which is time. There is an opportunity cost of paying things too early. Doing something early is not the same as creating more time. It's just taking something from tomorrow and moving it into today and then adding the risk that we call unexpected change cost. It's an underutilization. So in that case, I would say, yeah, if you're able to have the benefit today and extend the payment terms out in the future, as long as there's no factor of interest that comes into play, then that would be a great example of procrastinate on purpose.
Rory Vaden is the author of Procrastinate on Purpose. Rory, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure, David. Thank you for having me.
Last week, we asked you to tell us your stories of economic waiting. Andrew in Texas wrote about the time he spent waiting for a move back to his home state. But now that he's there, he's still waiting, this time for his finances to catch up so he can pay off his loans and buy a new car for his wife. Several listeners mentioned housing. Teresa in Indianapolis is saving up for a 10% down payment. Topher in Chicago is waiting to buy a condo, and he's worried that he's missing his chance to find the right place because he's afraid to take on debt. And then there's Angela Stumpert. She's been waiting a long time and is finally on the verge of fulfilling a 13-year goal.
My husband and I have been married for 13 years and are hoping to buy our first house in about a year. We've been waiting until the time was right. I'm an associate degree nurse, and my husband is a quality technician engineer. We finally paid off our van this month after 6 years. We consolidated our debt through an agency, and we are working with another company to get old credit blemishes removed. We both came from poor financial situations without much financial literacy. We have 4 wonderful kids in 11 years and a lot of debt despite working hard. We are paycheck to paycheck, but over time, we've learned to be really frugal with our family budget. It's been a long wait, but we're almost ready.
Next week, we're talking about cycles, things that repeat, things that are reborn. Maybe you're in the market for a used car. Maybe you're passing along old baby clothes to a friend. Tell us your story of economic cycles. Visit MarketplaceWeekend.org and click on Go or tweet us. We're at MarketplaceWKND. You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. So now that we've explored the economic aspects of waiting, it's time for a song. Singer and songwriter Amy Spies was inspired to write one when she reflected on the waiting game involved with buying a home.
We're head over heels in over our heads. We borrow and steal to pay the rent. How we gonna save any money that's already spent?
We borrow and steal to pay the rent. How we gonna save any money when it's already spent? I think this chorus is just the truth of, it just came out because it's the truth. Hi, I'm Amy Spies, and I'm sitting in my living room in East Nashville, Tennessee. I'm both a singer and a songwriter. It's a great life, but not a great living. I'll be honest about that. So I wrote this song called Spent that is just about the challenges that you have when you try to buy your first house with, you know, credit checks and things like that, and having the kind of the dream of buying a house, even as a songwriter or any kind of a creative artist. I picture a couple standing on the back porch of a house that they are renting that they realize that they might not be able to afford. You know, a year ago, I was in a position where I was renting a house and I was offered a chance to buy it. And I knew that I was able to buy it at a little bit lower than what the market value of that house would be. And I really wanted to buy it. And I'm in my 40s and I've been an artist my whole life since I got out of college. But because I'm an artist, I hadn't really saved money thinking of a down payment on a house. I'd actually kind of given up hope that I'd ever be able to buy a house because I was living in New York City. When I moved to Nashville, I realized that these houses were semi-affordable, and I had friends who were artists who were able to buy houses. So I started walking through the process of it, and it was a little frustrating to find out that my credit that I thought was actually fine was not fine enough for me to be able to get a mortgage at a good rate. It brought up a lot of fear for me, being the age I'm at. I'm also single. I definitely would never choose, I would never change what I've chosen to do. I just hope that there's a way for me to be able to have the same things that other people who are in the middle class have.
Once I heard someone singing a dream we could have and hold. Something of our own. Place to call home. We're head over.
Amy Spies lives in East Nashville, Tennessee. Her song Spent is about her home buying process. You can read more about Amy's financial turning point and the financial turning points of others in our collaboration with the New York Times called My Biggest Financial Lesson. Check it out online at marketplace.org. And while we're talking about housing and waiting, Stan Humphries is chief economist with Zillow.com. That's a real estate website. Stan, what'd you think of the tune?
You know, in terms of Amy's song, it was what she's singing about there is something that's pretty common for most Americans right now, or many Americans.
So what's your current take on the housing market?
We do a lot of affordability metrics each month, and we find that rental affordability is just at an all-time crisis level where, you know, rents have never been, you know, less affordable than they are right now. And that's a real problem. And of course, Amy really did a great job giving the emotional impact of what I think, you know, a lot of Americans are seeing right now.
So let's bring waiting back into the picture. Is it possible to time the housing market, whether you're a buyer or a seller?
When you say timing, I think most housing economists think about trying to time when you buy and sell. So, you know, buying low and selling high. And that's really hard because housing economists ourselves can never really agree on when the peaks and troughs are really going to occur. So it's even harder for consumers who have perhaps are looking at less information to figure out when's the peak of the market and the trough. But I think timing is important from the respect of thinking about overall whether you want to buy or rent a home because, of course, the biggest criteria for figuring out whether you want to buy or rent is how long are you going to be in the house because everyone understands if you're going to be in a house for 20 years, you should probably buy it. And if you're going to be in the house for 6 months, you should probably rent it. They just don't know where those two lines cross. You know, right now with really low mortgage rates, they actually cross pretty quickly at the U.S. level, about 2.3 years. So if you can live in a house longer than 2.3 years right now because of low mortgage rates, you should buy a home. Less than 2.3 years, you should rent. But that varies a lot metro by metro as well.
Amy Spies was looking to buy. Do the same criteria that affect her decision affect a seller?
They do generally. I mean, it's a little bit of a different dynamic when you think about, you know, optimal times of the year to sell versus buy. You know, you get your biggest discounts as a buyer in the wintertime because that's not when you see the most volume and therefore buyers can strike the have the best negotiating power, where sellers see the biggest premium in the springtime. In fact, right now is the peak time to be selling your home, where you're actually going to see the greatest premium over and above what it would sell otherwise. In terms of kind of overall beyond when in the year to buy or sell, in terms of the macro environment, you know, I would say there's not a huge difference in, well, again, unless you're trying to market time and unless you're trying to sell at the height of the market or buy at the bottom. But again, as I said, that's hard.
Most of the tea leaves that are out there suggest that the housing market is finding its footing and is stabilizing. How does that affect the decision to buy or sell?
Yeah, I think the market is, I mean, what we're seeing is a very slow healing process where the housing market, you know, each month and each year gets a little bit better. It's still a long ways off from normal, but it's getting better. You know, each year gets a little bit better for buyers.
Stan Humphries is chief economist at Zillow.com. Stan, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, David.
All right, let me check the phone again, see how I'm doing with the cable company. Well, that's not getting me anywhere. Let's roll the credits. I'll be back next week holding down the fort for Lizzie as she takes some time off. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Jenny Amen and Eliza Mills, with help this week from Tobin Lowe. Dan Samatovich is our senior producer. Charlton Thorpe's our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm David Lazarus of the LA Times. Next week, we'll explore the economics of cycles, not just the two-wheeled variety. Until then, I'll see you in the business section. This is APM.